You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, folks, today's podcast is brought to you by a great company called Warby Parker. Warby Parker makes eyewear. So the next time you need, I don't know, sunglasses or prescription glasses, go to warbyparker.com/BCS, as in The Brian Callen Show. Now, why? Why should you go to this great company? Well, let me tell you why. First of all, I bought four pairs of glasses from Warby Parker. Two were for as gifts. Here's why I love this company. Here's why I believe in this company. First of all, most sunglasses are very pricey, and it's because most sunglasses are owned, the companies that make them are owned by a few companies, big companies, and they jack the prices up in an artificial way, okay? Warby Parker's glasses are the same quality, but they start at $95, and they go up to about $150 tops, but that's for prescription glasses with titanium, Japanese titanium frames, and French non-rocking screws. I mean, the quality, you just have to touch them and feel them and realize that the quality is as good as anything out there. Okay, but here's the other awesome thing about this company. These guys will donate, for every pair you buy, they will donate a pair to someone in need. Think about that. For every pair you buy, they will donate to somebody in need. You can look good and make a difference in the world at the same time. This is a company that actually cares about people, not just the bottom line. I love it, okay? So go to warbyparker.com/BCS for all your eyewear needs. I promise you, you will be very happy. They will send you up to five pairs to your house. You can try them on, see what works. It's incredible. Okay, and send the ones you don't want right back. If you want prescription glasses, it takes about 10 business days. Overall, it's an awesome company. WarbyParker.com/BCS, as in The Brian Callen Show. They're just awesome. And they've got countless styles to choose from. WarbyParker.com/BCS. Thank you, Warby Parker.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're in luck. This is what I call a naked podcast. When I say naked, we don't have any esteemed academics. It's just me and the Motts. Me and the Motts.
Is it also called that because we are actually naked?
Yeah, well, I wish.
Do you?
No, you're not my type. But every time I do stand-up now, people go, tell Hunter Motts we say hi.
Yeah.
All right. Hi.
Hi.
From
hi, Brian.
The general public.
Whenever I go onto Twitter and my literally hundreds of followers reach out to me, they say, hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
You were saying that so much of what we're doing here with these podcasts is it's about human nature.
Yeah, I think that's all pretty much what it is, you know? I mean, people have...
We're learning about human nature, and
yeah.
The more we learn about human nature and the way the universal... similarities.
Mm-hmm.
We were about to have Paul Ekman on, and he was the guy who found that people everywhere, regardless of their exposure to other cultures or anything, have essentially a bulk of the same expressions.
Yeah, we come prepackaged. That's sort of the recurring theme. There's certain stuff that we come pre-wired with. Mm. So we come pre-wired for joy, fear, sadness, disgust, what Ekman calls the seven core emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And those have set facial expressions that we are, wired to make. And you can even see there's a reason why we can recognize the facial expressions of animals, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can tell when a dog is feeling shame, when a dog is happy,
mm-hmm.
Or a cow or anything like that. And that's because a lot of those emotional systems are the same. And that's why we're able to form those connections.
Orgasm is different. I've had enough experience.
Really? With
some
animals?
Some women sound like they're falling out of a building, always with me. And then other times they're like, hurry up, because the kids are listening and
any specific women that you
hair,
have in mind
careful
there?
My hair how
yeah.
much longer I'm tired so it depends on
but
depends
you've
on,
never had that experience
not me, not you. But then it kind of flies in the face of some of the stuff you've been doing, which is the idea that some people are born smart. You hate that, but some people do have better brains.
Well, I think that's the second part of it, is that on top of that, sort of the things that we come hardwired with, there's a tremendous amount of flexibility, right? You can rewire the brain to do whatever you
hardware
want.
Hardware versus software.
Software, exactly. Yeah. But even within that, you can even, based on your software, what you're doing, you can change your hardware. You can rewire the brain. And there's actually an amazing book out there called The Brain That Changes Itself by Norman Doidge, who, I mean, I would love to get on the show, but he's perennially busy because his book has been so successful. But the stuff that they have done with neuroplasticity, rewiring the brain, is truly amazing.
Is that the myelin sheath and all that?
Yeah, but he does a really good job of picking some of the wildest examples. So, for example, there was this guy, Paul Bachirita, who...
Sure, Bachirita.
Yeah, I think I probably sort of mixed languages.
Doesn't matter.
He's Spanish, but I Germanized it.
Bachirita.
He developed this chair, and the chair was hooked up to this camera. And the camera would then turn the images that it saw into, it had these rods in the back of the chair, and it would create an image on that. And he would have blind people lay in this chair. And through this chair, right, by it pushing patterns into their back, they ultimately learned to see images.
Oh, man.
That's how flexible it is. Or there was another great one.
So in other words, a dog would be like four prongs in the middle of your back as an example.
No, like actually they started seeing actual images in their head.
Because they could feel them on their back. So the outline of a dog would be on their back.
Yeah.
And they were able to see that in their head.
Yeah. And wow.
How do you describe what color is to a blind person who's never seen green?
I don't know.
Yeah, you don't know anything. But keep
No,
going.
I don't. But the one that I actually loved most was in the book, they really talk about the tongue as the USB port for the brain. Because if you look at, you know, that you've ever seen those maps where they do a drawing of the brain based on how much of it is devoted to different body parts, right? And what you see is, like, the tongue is huge, the hands are huge. There are certain body parts.
Well, children put things in their mouth for many years.
Right.
My mother looked at me and said, do you know what that remote control feels like in your mouth? I said, I do. I do. And she goes, because it's been there before.
Yeah.
You know, I remember it being in there, but I know I put shit in my mouth.
Yeah. But so there's an antibiotic called gentamicin. Mm. And in a very, very small number of cases, gentamicin causes inner ear damage. And what that means is that people can no longer balance. Mm-hmm. It's actually a terrible, terrible thing to have happen to you because you constantly feel like you're spinning. You can't really function, all of this stuff. So this guy developed this helmet, and what the helmet has is it has a little, a little balance, right? And then it turns those changes into electrical signals, which are then fed through onto a clip that you put on your tongue. And the result is that through this helmet, they're able to retrain the inner ear by transmitting these shocks to the tongue.
Damn. So it cures you a little bit?
Yeah, it does. No, it does. I mean, initially,
if you had to wear that all the time, it'd be a shitty job interview.
But. Yeah, but you wear it for hours at a time, and then you only wear it for minutes at a time, and eventually you've retrained your inner ear, and so you no longer need to wear the helmet.
How does it train the inner ear in relation to the tongue?
So essentially what's happening is that you're translating as you move your head to the left, right, the thing switches, and so that translates into certain electrical signals that are sent to your tongue, so your tongue gets like shocked a little bit, right? And then when it goes the other way, you get shocked in a slightly different way. And so through that, your head is learning, oh, my head is over to the left, which without your inner ear, you wouldn't know.
Okay.
So you're only finding that out because you're getting these electrical impulses into the tongue.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
But as you do this, essentially your brain is learning when it's to the left and when it's to the right, so that it's able to essentially reacquire that sense of balance.
God damn. That's crazy.
There's all sorts of crazy stuff that they've done like that. And, in the old days when people had a stroke, we used to basically just say, get used to not using the left side of your body. But now they actually, do real retraining with people, and they have great exercises where one of the big ones is to make people scour the insides of pans. And this is not just slave labor. It's actually, by having to do that motion, you're having to develop real muscle control and regain control over your body. And, you have these people who, 50 years ago because we believed, oh, you know, when the brain is damaged, there's nothing you can do, you're done. Now they're being able to regain a lot of functionality.
Because you're gaining new neural pathways.
And you're rewiring and, you know, the brain is taking over functions that, you know, other parts.
Because there's plasticity in the brain.
Because there's plasticity. And the most extreme example that he gives in the book is there was a girl who was born with half a brain. God. She literally was born with half a brain. One side of it, it's just this like empty water-filled sac, and it never developed. And this girl is obviously not a rocket scientist, but she, you know, is basically has the intelligence of a teenager. She can talk, she can walk, she can do all these sorts of things. And that's because the other side of her brain has, you know, taken over those functions.
Man.
So, you know, I think that's the thing. Again, that's why it's always dangerous. People tend to like be like, it's all nurture or it's all nature.
It's a combination.
And it's a combination, and that's the reality. But
And nurture can have a great deal to do with what your brain looks like at the end of the day. I mean, in other words, you can certainly change the hardware if you apply the right software.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the big thing. I mean, you know, the reason why we wrote The Straight A Conspiracy is because the one thing that is certain is that if you believe that, you know, you never got the math gene or you'll never have an ear for languages, well, you're not going to try. And then you're not going to do that rewiring. And, you know, that's Carol Dweck, who we had on the show. You know, there's all of those beliefs end up being self-fulfilling prophecies. Like, it takes, you know, this from comedy. You know this from your amateur boxing career.
not too amateur. Keep going.
Yeah. You know this from podcasting. You know this from lovemaking.
Lovemaking. You know. I call it fucking.
Okay.
I call it power fucking.
Okay.
F-U-C-K.
Is there a DVD available that can teach that? Power fucking.
Only inside
Brian
my mind and inside the minds of all the women I've been with.
Brian, I think that could be the new P90X. Power fucking. By Brian Callen.
By Brian Callen. This is my dick, everybody.
Work your hips.
There it is. And that song by the Stones is played over and over again.
And you didn't pay for the copyright. You just made it in your basement.
Fuck no.
And selling
copyright.
Copies
when
online,
the lawyer sent me a letter, I just sent him a picture of my genitals fully erect. Check this out on your copy. Copyright this, motherfuckers. See where I go? We're having this elaborate conversation.
It's important. I mean, listen, you know, that's what everybody loves. Everybody says this is the most fun interview they've done, and that's as it should be.
Yeah, because we're awesome.
Well, at least one of us is Brian.
Come on, Hunter. Stop being so modest.
But yeah, it all is basically, I mean, it's all the same. It all adds up to the same message. And yeah, obviously you need a realistic view. If you want to build a better society, you need a realistic view of how people actually work.
Well, the fascinating thing about talking to the people we talk to on this podcast and the things that we read and the articles you send me is that I'm constantly being reminded that the things I grew up with, the preconceived notions and philosophies and ideas are not always so right.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting
thing.
But
go on.
Well, I was going to say, you know, if you'd lived in the 1500s and then, you know, 50 years later, 1550, right?
Yeah.
It's not like the value system would have changed that much. But we live in a time that is evidence-based when there's new research, new discoveries being made. And so...
Well, but that's why I think that when you talk about scientists being religious, I don't so much think that's a fair way of describing scientists. I think that the more you learn about science and the more we learn about, you know, and when we should define what science is, right? Science is in many ways trial and error, experimentation and measurable result. Looking at data, statics, statistics, and things like that.
Totally.
It's very hard to refute that evidence and might even be detrimental to refute it. And so I do understand when scientists like Lawrence Krauss become what we've characterized as fundamentalist in their beliefs. I don't know that's fair, though, to use words like religious and fundamentalist I don't think those two words are applicable to scientists. I think
they are, because the point is that are you responding to the evidence or not? right? Like we all,
but they are, aren't they? I mean,
not always. I mean, look at someone like, you know, Peter Duesberg, right, or whatever his name is. The guy,
yeah,
who,
Duesberg. Duesberg is a good way. It's Duesberg, but Duesberg is a better way of fucking. That guy is irresponsible.
Yeah, the guy who's the AIDS denialist, yeah. Right? Or, you know, this latest Nobel laureate who's come out and said that global warming is a myth, right?
Yeah.
And the guy is responsible for doing, I mean, he did amazing stuff, but it's like the movement of electrons through in solid states. Like,
he
it's
has
solid
nothing
state.
To do with the
global
climate science,
yeah. Right? That doesn't mean that he couldn't figure it out. I'm sure that he could, but who knows what his agenda is or why he's doing it. But, you know, is it responsible of him to do this? And of course, you know, for people who want to be global,
you're saying that scientists can be religious. And,
of
I mean,
course
Newton,
they can.
Newton was very religious.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that belief in the scientific method.
The scientific method is flawless and perfect. But science is filled with human beings.
Yes.
And, you know, human beings are, you know, I mean, one of the things that we found out from this podcast, human beings are groupish. Like, we like to form little groups and tribes.
Yeah.
And there are groups and tribes in science. And, you know, when you challenge the orthodoxy of a group or a tribe with some sort of new evidence, they often don't like to give it up.
Do you have any religion in you?
Well, I think the capacity for religion is within all of us, and we believe in certain things, mm-hmm. right? You know, I believe in science. I believe in all that sort of stuff.
In other words, maybe the way I would describe my religion is I believe that there's an optimistic movement. I'm optimistic about human development movement and that this is all happening for a reason. I like believing that. And scientists would kind of chuckle at me and say, of course you do.
Because, maybe. Yeah. I think what science often doesn't realize is that, I mean, and that's sort of a lot of what this progress has been about, is realizing that, you know, science is whatever it is, but science always exists within human beings.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's more or less true. There's always, it's very easy
well,
for...
Well, truth is something human beings have always looked for, right?
Yeah, but always truth is experienced through a human mind. And the human mind, because it... You know, I mean, what we were going to talk to Paul Ekman about, I mean, part of it is that emotions organize thinking, right? So they shape it,
yeah.
Right? Your view of the world, if you're happy today, is going to be totally different from your view of the world if you're unhappy, right? You will pick out different facts. You will see things in a different way. You can watch the same news story and interpret it in two different ways, right? You see whatever, you know, you see those two guys who escape from jail and you're happy, right? And you're like, man, these people only report the worst things. Why are they fixating on these two people? Blah, blah, blah. You're in a bad mood and you see that. You're like, the world has gone to hell in a handbasket. It's all falling apart. Everything's bad, right?
Sure.
But that's not, and so you, if you.
Well, I also think, though, that it's interesting, and David Sloan Wilson talks about this. You may deny that religion is true or that it you may talk about religion in derogatory terms the way Richard Dawkins does, but the fact is it is there. It does exist, and it has existed a long time, and I suspect it will for a long time, at least in the imagination of the human mind.
Exactly, and it's disingenuous to pretend that somehow you have transcended your own biology.
There you go.
The reality is that, you know...
So the question becomes, why is it there? Is it there because we human beings are always looking for answers and truth, and when we don't have the evidence, measurable evidence, we'll come up with mythology? But then that begs another question. You know, that would suggest if you ridicule mythology, you're saying it's not important. My God, mythology is important.
100%.
And I'll define mythology in these terms, at least for me. The idea that there is at least in your mind's eye a perfect state for the world and for yourself. And so I spend my days reaching for that.
But isn't that true of both political parties? And isn't that true
absolutely.
Of most modern economists?
I yes.
mean, you know.
Yes.
You know, Mike Callan, is Mike Callan religious?
No.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
He is.
He's about the free market.
About
he sure
the free
is.
Market, he's religious.
Yes.
And the point is that like any human being, it's not that he is unique in this. In fact, it's that he belongs with the rest of humanity. When evidence comes in that doesn't fit with what he believes, right, he
right.
reinterprets it to be able to dismiss it.
That's right.
Right? And that's what human beings do. But that's really my point. We all have to be honest that this is how human thinking works, that we all do this. And once we're honest about who we are, then you can start to say, okay, recognizing that we all have this tendency towards groupishness, we all have this tendency to buy into certain worldviews, certain belief systems, and to want to reject anything that doesn't fit with them, then we can approach all of the evidence with the humility that science demands and really start to say, are the beliefs that we hold really true? Are we operating in a way that's fair?
Well, yeah, and also, where is their place? There is validity to you know, certain mythology and its place. It does make the world a better place.
Potentially. I think that's the thing.
Yeah, I mean, depending.
Yeah, I think you have to just...
I'm definitely not ready to get rid of that kind of... I mean, I don't want to get rid of... Star Wars is mythology. I mean, there are a lot of things like that, but we... look, there are two things that I remember. Ferris Bueller's Day Off was a seminal movie for me because he in the end, he's lying on his bed and he goes, just don't forget to smell the coffee, or don't forget to stop and smell the roses on your way to where you're trying to get to, because you might miss it, or something like that. I remember as a kid
life
saying...
Life goes pretty fast.
Yeah, and I remember going, man, yes, yes. And as I get older, I realize the value of just a good meal and laughter with friends. And then the second movie was at Pope of Greenwich Village, where I can't remember the actor's name. He's Charles Durning. What an actor. I think it was him. And he said, he's got to leave town because the mafia is going to, it's done. He's got the laws after him or something. And he's getting on a train. And he sees his wife. He's been married to her for 50 years. And he kisses her for the last time. He's never going to see her again. And she says, how could you let this happen to you? And he says, I let my whole life happen to me. And he leaves. And I said to myself when I was probably 18, I said, that's never going to be me, man. I'm never doing that. I will never say that to anybody, especially not my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that was a story. And that was, you know, a fictional story. And that was this, then there was a moral behind that story. And there was, you know, ideas of how you should behave, how you shouldn't, based on morality and ethics. And regardless of whether there was brain science involved, I wasn't interested in that. What I was interested in is not making bad mistakes and 100%. Being inspired to be a better person.
And that's, I think, that's the point. You can't escape. Humans love story, right? We are emotional. You know, our brains are plastic.
Mm.
You know, we are motivated by selfishness, but we also have other motivations. It's not our only motivation. And you need this realistic picture of who we are, and we are groupish, right? And so, you know, that's part of the problem with, you know, overemphasizing individualism. It's certainly the problem with putting people in solitary confinement. You have to be realistic about how human beings work. And when you really embrace the truth of human nature, then you can build a better society, a better life for yourself.
In other words, you can solve big problems.
Huge problems. Yeah exactly. And I mean, I think that's amazing and that's empowering, and we're lucky to live in that time. And I think what people always don't realize is that any of these political systems or economic systems that were developed, they were built on a view of human nature, right?
100%. I mean, look at capitalism.
100%. And, you know, how was Adam Smith coming up with that view of human nature? He was traveling around Europe as a tutor and paying attention to what people did. He thought, he reflected, he read a bunch of writing, but it wasn't based on empiricism. It wasn't that we had really dug in, looked at the neurons. They didn't even know about neurons. So obviously his view of human nature is going to be simplistic and it's going to be flawed. I mean, it's amazing that he came up with what he did in 1776, but to think that that is going to be something that is going to stay static for the next, you know, 1,000 years is as ridiculous as thinking that whatever, you know,
the earth is flat or whatever.
Or that a bunch of guys wandering around in the Sinai in the Bronze Age, right?
Yeah.
Had figured out all the answers to all the problems we would ever face.
Yeah.
Many of those things.
I have the Ten Commandments tattooed to my back.
Do you, Brian?
Carved, actually.
Do you know
back.
That there was a third tablet?
No. God damn it. Damn it.
It was the 15th commandment, but. Then shit. Moses was like, I don't know that I really want to follow these rules. And then he just smashed
Some
it.
Some constitutional scholars said most of us break at least 3 or 4 of the commandments every single day.
Well, I mean, certainly the first 3.
Yeah.
Right?
Take the Lord's name in vain.
Yeah, do that.
Bear false witness.
Yeah.
We all lie a little bit.
Honor thy father and mother.
Never. And my father was telling me how he lost weight. He's losing weight, which he actually is, but I didn't want to give it to him. We were playing golf.
Mm-hmm.
He still got that belly. And I looked at him. I went, You are losing weight. I mean, I don't see it. Like, I mean, one has to have a very nuanced eye. I mean, I haven't measured this. You've got to know how to really measure a sphere to the nth degree. But I'm sure that if I had some instruments, if NASA yeah. was out here with their instruments, we'd probably see some reduction in the sphere you call your belly.
What was it that you said at your dad's 50th birthday party about his workout and what he does with his coach?
Well, you know, he's got this guy, Ted, who is went to Harvard, and he knows everything about exercise. He's actually really, really smart, and he worked me out. I mean, the guy knows everything. He's a guru when it comes to this. I mean, a really informed, smart dude who got his master's in exercise physiology from Harvard. The guy knows everything. And my father hires him, and I was like, you know, what exactly? You guys have been working out for 6 years. What are you guys, what shape are you guys going for? He looks like the letter eight, or the number eight fucking guy. It's like the number eight on sticks. And I was like, what are you doing? Like, can we get some results here?
Well, I mean, again, maybe that's the result he's going for. Maybe he wants to be on Sesame Street.
Maybe. 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 I don't know.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my friend, this has been real.
It has been real.
That was a good conversation.
That was a good conversation. Are we really going to cut it off at whatever this is, 23 minutes? Come on, Brian. You got another 7 minutes.
Yeah, I do. I got time. I think you got another
7 minutes.
I got plenty of time. I'm just saying.
Well,
I keep sending my wife a video of myself for no reason.
Well, that's important.
I sent her a video of myself just smiling.
Yeah.
Like, and I just smiling and then holding the smile for a long time.
How long into that smile does it get creepy?
Well, I hold it for a good 2 minutes. That's when it gets creepy.
At 2 minutes? But do you think it's at 2 minutes or like 12 seconds or minute 30?
It's a good question.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know. It's an interesting thing.
Here's another question for you, Brian.
Yeah.
Who do you want me to book? And this also goes for our listeners.
Barack Obama. What would you ask Barack Obama?
I would ask him mostly. That's tough. I mean, I definitely want to ask him about what does he think the price of not having a clear foreign policy is. I also would want to know, why did you say that campaign finance was issue number one when you first ran, and then you've done nothing about it?
Ooh.
And instead have, like, spurred more campaign finance. I'd want to know, how much power do you think that the president realistically
has? That's what I'd like to know.
Yeah. And what should we be voting for a president based on? Like, what should our shopping criteria be? Because if the president... Because, like, for example, how much power does the president have in education or any of these sorts of things?
I'd ask him if he regrets not having any direct economic experience or direct experience with the economy. Not having run a business, not having had to turn a profit. And I wonder how important that is to the presidency. What do you think of that? I mean, isn't it if you're worried about the economy, does it make sense to vote in an economic stud like Mitt Romney or not?
Well, firstly, is Mitt Romney an economic stud?
A lot of people who have businesses and who are in the banking world, I've heard them use that expression. I don't know, but he did very well with Bain Capital.
Totally.
He clearly made a lot of money.
Yeah, totally.
I don't think it was done in nefarious ways. I think he was a good businessman, a sensible, smart, hardworking guy. But it doesn't have to be Mitt Romney. Look, I mean, there are people. Why don't we vote for why don't we say, hey, Warren Buffett, come in here and run our country since you know how to run a business whoever.
I think that's the point, is what is your model of government and what is your model of the function of government? And just because you're successful in business, that doesn't mean that you do or do not have a good model of how a government should be run.
Because a government is different than a business?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're different, but I think also, you know, what is people's model in general? Like, what was George Bush's model for dealing with terrorism, right? And the point is that guy had...
It was mine. It was mine. Simplistic as shit. Yeah. Let's go in there. I'd like to criticize him, but basically, I was right with him.
Well,
let's
exactly.
Let's fucking go in there with gunships, special forces, guys. Let's go kill all those fucking assholes. I mean, literally, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, most of America was right on board with him. And that's the disingenuous thing, is to try and pretend that we didn't want that. We did want that. We wanted blood.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, obviously, George W. Bush ran a business, right? He ran the Texas Rangers. But
he was not an accomplished man.
No, but the point is, I mean, on paper, certainly.
My father loves to say, he went to Yale. You don't get into Yale. But what are you talking about?
Well, he went to Yale and he went to Harvard Business School.
Yeah, but
and
he ran the Texas
Rangers. Yeah. Well, but see, that's the point.
He was not a self-made man in any way.
No, I agree.
He was born on home base.
Well, and also, I mean, that also lets you know a lot about how college admissions works.
Yeah.
Right? So, but I think that's the thing. You know, you could say on paper, right? George W. Bush is the person that you should vote for, right? He's a businessman. You know, he has these amazing degrees.
On paper, yeah.
On paper, but the reality
is, for that matter, Barack Obama didn't leave much of a legacy at all. I mean, he wasn't a brilliant legislator. He was not a brilliant academic.
No.
And he wasn't even a very, I mean, and he was a community organizer, I think, before that, which I don't even know what the fuck that means. An eloquent speaker.
Yeah.
You know, but grew up in a very different way even than I did. I don't agree with a lot of, you know what I realized that shaped a lot of my shit was I got in a fight with my wife in a real one last night because she said I don't live in the real world. The problem that I had with that is that was I felt it was disrespectful because as a comic and an actor and the disappointment and shit I've dealt with all that time and I've failed way more than I've succeeded. I consider that, and even not to be, you know, but even just as an athlete, just being a wrestler, I was good. In Taekwondo, I was pretty good. I mean, I won lots of stuff. That was very difficult. It was very scary. It was also kind of, I did it on my own in that sense, right? Being a stand-up comic is not easy when you're starting out. You're on your own. Nobody can help you. No money, no nothing. It's either you make it or you don't. And by the way, acting was exactly the same way. Nobody's in there in the audition room for me. So for me, I always feel like I really did compete in a marketplace. And I competed on my own. And I always think of it as like, I don't know. I think that I never could rely on the government or bailouts or anything.
Yeah, but you did rely on the government. You relied on the government because you live in the United States.
I understand. I'm just saying that
Brian, if you want to talk about stand-up comedians, and this is not to denigrate what you've been through.
Yeah, but let me just be clear on my point. My point was simply that I think it influences how I think about government and how I think about people who live and work for work in a job that is more guaranteed than say the private sector would be. So if there's no accountability and you're guaranteed your job because you work for a big union or you whatever it might be, I think that's a different way of living. And it always tends to rub me a little bit the wrong way because maybe I have an emotional reaction to that because I have not lived that way.
Totally. Yeah. But by the way, actually, one of the people that I want to get on. So the Financial Times just came out with their summer book list, like what people should be reading. And the number one book that Francis Fukuyama, right, you know, darling of the right,
Piketty?
Recommended.
Piketty?
No. It was called Bring Back the Bureaucrats. And if you read Fukuyama's latest book, it's all about the fact that Americans' irrational anti-government feelings have caused us to strip away government that we actually do need.
Sure.
And I think that's the thing. I mean, listen, I don't disagree. There are certainly, I mean, I've had, fortunately, not many conversations with the IRS, but every time I talk to an IRS agent, right, they just sound dead inside.
Sure. Yeah, it's a tough job.
It's a tough, tough, tough job. But you know, there's job security in some sense. But you know, there are other challenges. Certainly, I mean, nobody calls up the IRS and it's like, "Wow, how are you doing? I hope you're having a great day."
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know. So, I mean, I 100% understand what you're saying about you know, secure government jobs and all of that stuff. But I mean, yeah, I mean, when I think of stand-up comics, I always think of Zarganar, who was the, you know, so everybody knows Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, who won the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
But
everybody does, I certainly didn't know how to pronounce her name, but thank you, Hunter. Nerd.
But Zarganar was the dissident stand-up comic in Burma. and was constantly challenging the regime and was constantly being sent to prison and all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, absolutely, like, you face struggles, but you do live in the United States, and that government apparatus, the cultural history that we've inherited, enable you to not have to think about, do I want to or do I not want to challenge the government and risk getting locked up?
Yeah.
But, you know, that government apparatus helps maintain that. It's not the only basis of maintaining it. Part of it is cultural. A large part of it is cultural.
And part of it is the lack of government apparatus.
Totally, 100%. Yeah. But the conversation, I think, in general, is there's this bizarre this bizarre conversation where you have the liberals who are like, we need, you know, government is good. And then the conservatives are saying government is always bad. And what we should be trying to decide is, where is government appropriate? Where is it helpful? Where does it support our society and support innovation and all of those sorts of things?
That's where the debate and discussion should live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
and what gets in the way of that kind of debate is religion on both sides.
Exactly.
Fundamentalism on both sides.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's part of what I've learned from this podcast, is just that's how you should also look at a human being.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain traits we all share, and then there is something to be said about nurture and versus nature, but nurture and software versus hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the best ratio, which is probably right. always changing. You know.
Yeah, and I think in general, just to be able to constantly have calm conversations where, you know, like our last guest was saying, right, there is a certain amount of levity, and there is the ability to question, to dissent, to pick these things apart, to figure out, okay, how does this work? Does this make sense? Is this producing the result that we want? Because obviously our moral intuitions about, you know, criminals are bad, right? They should be locked away. Like, the more of them we lock away, the better off we are. They should be in solitary confinement.
Right.
All of that sort of stuff, except you look at what that then does, and it doesn't serve your desire for safety and security.
Right.
So, yeah, I just think in general, we should, you know, be able to have a conversation and recognize that, yes, we do all have religions.
Solving the problem, a lot of times we try to solve a problem based on our emotional apparatus mm-hmm. and our belief system, and that's not the best way
no.
to go about it. No. I've learned that. God damn it.
But also to use our emotional apparatus to solve that, and I think that's why comedy is so important. You know, there are conversations like that's what I think has been so interesting is, you know, bringing all these academics on and just the number of them that are like, this is the best interview I've ever had. Like, wow, such a great conversation. And it's because you help create an environment in an emotional environment in which they can really express themselves. And now
we
worry.
Also read the book.
That does help.
And I also really appreciate anybody who takes the time to write a book. Jesus mm-hmm. Christ. I mean, like, Adam
Benforado.
You're so good with names. Adam Benforado. That's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work. And by the way, it's a lot of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these people are compassionate. Mm-hmm. They're trying to solve a problem. And man, they sit down and go, I'm going to try to figure this out. And I really appreciate that. That takes a lot of, it's exciting and it's fun and it's their mission, but it takes courage. And it takes a great deal of empathy.
And I think that's the thing. I mean, I love that Adam Benforado said that, you know, the big problem is taking all of this neuroscience and bridging it to the public. And that's why he wrote this book. I mean, he understands that.
Yeah.
And that's why, like he said, this is originally a 600-page book, but I wanted to get it to something that a person would actually want to read. And that's where that empathy really comes in. He's really thinking about, what does my reader want? What does my reader need? What's a good book for them?
If I count to 10,
yeah,
and I'm going to, I want the 3 or 4 guests who stand out in your mind we've had in this podcast. It's not easy. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You couldn't do it.
No, I've got 2.
Go ahead.
But I'll have to think about the third. So the first is definitely Jared Diamond.
Okay.
He was amazing and just such a treat, I think, for both of us to be able to speak to one of our favorite people of all time.
Yep.
Darren Acemoglu.
Yep.
Really.
Certainly seminal works on.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
And then, God, that's tough. That is really, really tough. Oh, John Nagle.
John Nagle was pretty damn good.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've had the privilege of talking to a lot of these people and really having conversations.
What about you? Do I have to now count to 10, demonstrate my counting skills?
I don't think so, because I would have to say that might be right where I'm at, because I'm a copycat and I don't like to think too deeply. Ladies and gentlemen, I've got to run to SAG. I know it's a lame excuse, but I got.
Oh, it's not, Brian. Why? Just explain.
Screen Actors Guild. Yes.
Oh my God, are you a member of the union?
Working actor.
Wait a minute, Brian. Right? Let's be clear. How do you normally feel about unions?
Well, I'm a member of the union. I don't want to go into the details of that.
How does Big Mike Callen feel about the fact that his son is a union member?
All I have to say is thank God for my union. So go fuck yourself. Peace, everybody.
Talk to you guys soon.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.